All right, Pappy, it's time for KVRX to take over co-op. It's on Monday through Friday, 7 to 9, and Saturday and Sunday, 10 to 9.
It does smell like a hint of pine.
It operates at 91.7 megahertz at 3,000 watts.
Down nuts! That guy's hilarious!
Shut up, old man!
I don't own a van!
And now, another day of none of the hits, all of the time on KVRX Austin.
Austin Johnson, me and him go way back. Man, one day we were going fishing, and we went down the hole.
Toll booths are everywhere. Deliver me to my destination. Smoke is in the air. Land jobs are on the left. The right lane is too slow. Cruise control is on 85. The gauge is getting low. Black Cadillac. Shifter on the floor. Carburetor stole my soul last night. Blow that 454. Black Cadillac. Black Cadillac. Black Cadillac. Black Cadillac.
Welcome to tonight's edition of In the Know. I'm Jorge Olivares.
I'm Aaron Aiken.
And I'm Katie Dempsey.
And tonight on In the Know, we're going to be talking about climate change, the environment, all issues that affect all of us here in the United States. We have two very special guests with us tonight. We have Perla Saravia Johnson. She has written a new book entitled Global Warning. And we also have Bruce Melton. He's with Melton Engineering. I would like to welcome both of y'all to our show.
It's very nice to be here.
I'm very happy to be here. And so let's just go ahead and start from the top. Ms. Saravia Johnson, you've written a new book entitled Global Warning. Now, what got you to write this book exactly?
Well, I guess it was 3 years ago when I was visiting my family in San Antonio and taking that drive back to Dallas. And I was astounded at what I saw around me. And what I saw was the big mega trucks and the huge SUVs with one person only in the car, and they were not taking short trips. I was tracking those vehicles, and they practically made it to the five-hour drive to Dallas in those huge cars with one person in the car. And I was thinking how selfish we are here in Texas. I've lived in other parts of the country, such as Vermont and Wisconsin, where the citizens are really in tune with what they can do to protect their environment and choose more friendly cars as far as environmentally friendly cars and more environmentally friendly lifestyles as well.
And do you think this is a Texas phenomenon? Or like how you were saying, I mean, the person was taking a trip from San Antonio to Dallas, but do you think, I mean, everybody else in the country is doing the exact same thing?
Well, I think that there are other parts of the country. I've lived in New England, and folks there really focus in on public transportation. And I, you know, I've lived in Vermont and Wisconsin where you have mandatory recycling. And I think one of the situations here with Texans is we love our freedom. We don't like government ramming things down our throats. And we love our space, and we love our big lifestyles with big vehicles and having our own personal space.
Now, the title of your book, it's Global Warming, obviously going with the idea of global warming. Now, what got you, I know the book is a sci-fi novel. Why did you choose to write it in that way?
Well, I wanted it to be entertaining. There's already been a lot of literature and documentaries and so on that kind of lecture to the public. And I wanted to grab the public's attention by giving them an entertaining story. So as you read the novel, you will actually find that it's multi-genre because it has a lot of action. It has a murder mystery. There's a romance. And although most of the story unravels in Dallas and in Canyon Lake and in New Braunfels, it actually turns out to be a global story. So I've used a lot of my own personal background in the story. You'll see that the plot moves to Miami and how climate change affects that area. The plot moves to Poland, where the protagonist, Dustin Jones, gets tangled in a web of murder and corruption. And the plot also moves to Cuba, where my family's from. And there are some dramatic changes that take place in Cuba, not only with the environment, but with the government as well.
And you said that it took you about 3 years to actually get the final product out. Why did you think 2009 or 2008, when it actually did come out, why do you think that was the perfect time for this book to be released?
Well, if you pay close attention to what's happening now in the news, there seems to be more awareness and more of a move for the eco or the green movement. I mean, we have blue-collar jobs, we have white-collar jobs. We are going to be hearing more and more about green-collar jobs. And our new president and the new administration has really put an emphasis on looking at renewable energy and alternative energy sources, and even creating more of these green jobs to actually help our economy, which is really sagging right now, as we all know.
And how much research did you put behind this work?
Well, I am a former journalist and not a scientist, and so I thought it was very important for me to interview the scientists so I could get the real science and then build upon that to make it an entertaining science fiction story. So I was just amazed and very pleased at the high-level experts that gave me their time so that I could do my research. So some of the folks that I interviewed, John Laurier in Washington, D.C. He is a program officer for climate change for the science program. I also had the opportunity to interview Dan Ton, and he is a grid integration specialist for solar technology in our nation's capital. And I also wanted to find out about future technologies in agriculture as a result of climate change. So I interviewed Stephen King at Texas A&M, who is a horticultural professor. I also had the opportunity to talk to one of the curators at the Smithsonian Museum in D.C. as well. So with their help, I was able to get the real science and then build upon that to make it an exciting story that people would enjoy, but that has a very special message as well.
Now, I know this book, it's a sci-fi thriller, it's set in the future, but, you know, a lot of these books entertain, but what else do you want someone who picks up this book and reads it by the end of the time that they've read it, kind of what kind of questions do you want them asking or things that they're thinking about their own government when, by the time they put the book down?
Well, that is an excellent question, and I did write this for a specific purpose. To entertain, yes, but also so that we could all reflect on our lives and realize that if we continue with our selfish lifestyles of just thinking about ourselves and present day and not thinking about what we are doing to endanger our planet and what type of planet we're going to leave behind for future generations, what is it that we can do to make immediate changes in our lifestyle? And I do say immediate. What can we do? Let's take a look at the cars we're driving. Let's take a look at the temperature that we are heating our homes in and cooling our homes. Let's take a look at all the new products that we buy. Do we really need to be going on our whims? Do we really need huge homes that are pulling more energy? I think as we look at what this administration is focusing on as far as trying to look into renewable energy sources and really making that a priority, not only to help our dependence on foreign oil, but to create new jobs to stimulate this economy. So that is what I want the message to be, for people to reflect on their lives and see what are the immediate changes that they can make to really make Earth a better place and a healthier place for us and for future generations.
Now, also, you mentioned the story driving from San Antonio to Dallas. Was there anything else, maybe in your work as an author before that as a journalist, that kind of turned you on to this realization that we're maybe not making the best use of our resources or just blatantly overusing them? Was there any kind of story that you were writing up for a paper or something and then you came across this and thought, well, you know, I didn't initially know about this, and, well, maybe I want to learn more?
Well, I think it's just traveling to different parts of the country and having lived in different parts of the country, where, as I say, in New England, for example, you have so much of the population that depends and uses public transportation. You do not see these huge vehicles on the road driving long distances with one person. You see that people are happy to recycle. You see that they're composting. You see that they, and then I've also got my in-laws that live in New Mexico, which is a very environmentally friendly state, where folks don't even take pride in having grass in their yard like we all do here. I think we're very spoiled. They xeriscape, and people say, oh, well, I don't want a yard with just cactus and rocks, but it looks beautiful. It's just we have to train ourselves, I think, to a new way of thinking. And I think just having traveled and having family and having lived in these other parts of the country has really opened up my eyes.
Well, you're listening to In the Know on 91.7 KVRX. If you'd like to make a comment or something that Ms. Perla Sarabia Johnson has been talking about for the past couple of minutes, or if you'd like to just pretty much leave your two cents on the idea of climate change or environmental issues facing the country at this moment, give us a call at 512-495-KVRX or blog with us at www.kvrx.org/in the know. And we'll be right back.
Latinas face the highest rates of teen pregnancy, school dropout, substance abuse, and suicide attempts of all their peers? Unfortunately, media doesn't do much in promoting a positive self-image for young Latinas. Ugly Betty aside, they are either missing entirely from magazines, television, and films, or they are placed in stereotypical roles of the maid, gangster chola, or hot-blooded sexy Latina. Turning statistics and stereotypes on their head is Latinitas, focused on empowering Hispanic girls with media and technology through reporting, web design, digital photography, radio, and video production. To volunteer, go to www.latinitasmagazine.org. This is a public service announcement from Latinitas and KVRX Austin.
KVRX, the only student-run radio station in Austin, broadcasts live from the University of Texas campus. We are dedicated to providing unique music that just can't be found anywhere else. KVRX is not mainstream and doesn't force the same 40 songs down your throat. We simply play none of the hits all the time.
KVRX.
This portion of KVRX programming is brought to you in part by the UT Performing Arts Center, featuring World of Sound with special guest Ghostland Observatory, live at Bass Concert Hall, Friday, January 30th at 8 p.m. For ticket information, you may visit utpac.org. KVRX thanks the UT Performing Arts Center for their support.
This portion of KVRX programming is brought to you by Pie Guys Pizzeria, located at 2222 Rio Grande in the heart of West Campus, and is now accepting Bebo Bucks. This Sunday, Pie Guys is hosting a Super Bowl party with slices and beer combos beginning at 2 p.m. Enjoy watching the game on 4 HD TVs, and for you smokers, they have an outdoor smoking patio. Plenty of West Campus parking available in the garage and will be validated by Pie Guys. Prizes will be handed out after every quarter during the Super Bowl. More information is available online at pieguyspizza.com or 477-PIES. That's 477-7437. KVRX thanks Pie Guys Pizzeria for their support.
Listening to In the Know 91.7 KVRX Austin. We have both Perla Sarabia Johnson and Bruce Melton here in the studio with us tonight. We're talking about climate change and the environment and how it affects you and I. And Ms. Sarabia Johnson, I know you're not from the Austin area, so if anybody would like to get your book or speak with you, how would they be able to do that?
Well, on Saturday, January 31st, I will be signing copies of my book at the Barnes & Noble at the Arboretum Shopping Center, and that's on 10,000 Research Boulevard from 2 to 4 this Saturday. I'd love to see as many of your listeners there as possible. It'd be great.
And do you have is there a website in which...
Yes, it's www.publishedauthors.net/PJohnson2008, or just Google my name, Perla Sarabia Johnson. It'll come up.
Perfect. Well, Ms. Sarabia Johnson, we'd like to thank you for coming on In the Know to give your little insight on this phenomenon we know as global warming, or as you say, global warming, which in fact it is something that we should be all thinking about in the coming years. And that's where we get to our next guest, Mr. Bruce Melton. He is with Melton Engineering, and he also dabbles with a little bit of the climate change and what exactly an advocacy group, I'm assuming, for climate change. And I know you've kind of traveled pretty a lot of different places trying to raise awareness about such things. So go ahead and introduce yourself. Let us know what you're all about. Let our listeners know exactly what you do.
Bruce Melton. I'm an engineer and a researcher. Some people call me a scientist. I don't have an advanced degree, just a bachelor's. Been engineering, doing environmental specialty work for 25 years. And in the early 90s, I was working for the environmental program at the LCRA, doing stormwater research, looking at water quality treatment. And I was associated a lot with weather issues. And I started getting interested in climate change, started reading some academic papers. And my understanding from the academic papers was different from what was coming out of the media. And everybody has heard of the alarmist media. What I was reading, and this is coming from somebody who's, you know, done $1 million of EPA research, I kind of am able to interpret the scientific literature. These papers were worse than what the alarmist media was saying. And this went on for years and years, really. It went on for about a decade. And got to the point where it was the disparity between the two was so great that I had to start writing about it. So I actually had a publisher at one time. I wanted to do a full-color book. This was right before Al Gore came out with his full-color book. And they didn't want to do full-color, so I turned them down, one of the greatest mistakes of my life. Since then, the disparity has gotten greater. And it got so great that I had to go to the Arctic to see for myself. I just couldn't believe it myself. And so now comes the astonishing part. Science, by definition, is conservative. The scientist, everybody's heard of publisher perish. If a scientist is wrong, the peer-reviewed journals, the academic journals that publish their findings, their discoveries, if he's wrong more than a few times, these juries won't recommend his paper for publishing. He'll never get past the review process, and he'll never get published. So now the perish part of publisher perish comes in, and the scientist finds him no longer scientist. And so science, by nature, is conservative. When I went to the Arctic, I saw that the academic papers were more alarming than the alarmist media. When I went to the Arctic, I found that in real life, climate change was more alarming than the academic papers. So there's this double whammy going on here. Since then, things have really started to heat it up. It was just a year and a half ago when I went to the Arctic. We crossed this climate threshold, it looks like, sometimes after the first of this new century. And the rate of change has sped up dramatically. And we've seen a lot of this increase in speed in things like the Arctic sea ice records dramatic records that broken that they've had. Carbon dioxide concentrations in our atmosphere, sea level rise, all these things are speeding up very rapidly. 20, 30, 40, 50 years, in some cases 100 years ahead of the supercomputer model projections. The Antarctic continent, which was long considered very widely to be not only a stable place where the ice wasn't melting or discharging more, it was snowing more down there. In the last decade, in the last 3 or 4 years, really, new technology, satellites 100 times more powerful than the previous satellites, gravimetric satellites measure gravity, have found that not only is Antarctica losing ice, but it's losing ice as fast as Greenland. So my quest, I've been making films since I got back from Greenland, trying to get funding through the National Science Foundation, Sundance. I've got one film into South by Southwest. I've already been turned down on one. And I'm singing. I'm singing for science. I do things graphically. And I learned at the LCRA, the Lower Colorado River Authority, when I worked there, I learned how to, but learned part of how to interpret science for general consumption, but also learned that one of the great ways to get people to understand complicated subjects is through images. And I've recently turned this into song as well. Somebody once told me that you can't, the scientific theorems don't go through your head all day long, but song lyrics do. And so that's some of the music you've heard tonight.
Well, yeah. In fact, your band Climate Change, which you were the principal singer and songwriter for, is, yeah, definitely stuff that we've heard off the CD. And thanks for bringing that in.
So, yeah, it's my pleasure.
That So I saw on your website you did a video that you made in Greenland, and you're showing sort of where the ice used to reach. And over a period of 2 years, it was several football fields in length already had receded. Now,
that's astonishing. It was the story. Volkswagen built a research winter proving grounds 80 miles up on the ice cap. To get to it, you have to drive. They also built a road, the longest road in Greenland, 17 miles long. Greenland is a very sparsely populated place. You drive 17 miles down this road, you get up on the ice cap, and it's 80 miles to their winter proving grounds. It's the road up onto the ice cap is what you were seeing in the film. And what happened there is the scientists call this threshold passing. In Greenland, they call it the Big Melt. And it started sometimes 2003, 2004. Volkswagen built the road in 2001. They were using it up until 2004. You got to get a guide to take you up to the ice. And I went up to the edge of the ice. Guides dropped me off. I camped for 3 or 4 days, for 4 days, 3 nights. My guide told me, oh, yeah, it's a Danish gal. I said, oh, yeah, the ice used to go all the way up there where the road was. And you can see in my film tourists walking along this ridge. That ridge is where the road was. And it's well more than 100 vertical feet. It's thousands of feet to the ice. But the ice has melted well more than 100 vertical feet since 2004. And I was there making the film in 2007. Just astonishing. It's one of the things that when I finally realized that, hey, this is, the scientific literature really is conservative. The scientists really are conservative. I've always heard publisher perish. But to see this amount of melt, Volkswagen was using that road that's 100 feet on this ridge way up there. They were using that road up until 3 years ago. It's just astonishing.
I know something that you mentioned is the fact that there's just this complexity that comes with science. And I know myself, I get confused with the big old hoopla of what exactly is going on. And I know a majority of people think the same way. And I know how you were saying about just with song or just with images, there's a way to convey that, hey, this is what's happening in our world. And because of most of the actions that we're doing, and some of them not man-made, but I know a majority of them are man-made, what exactly is happening to our environment. It kind of just doesn't hit you until you see it or until you hear it. I mean, there's a lot of jargon out there that the layman does not understand. And I know the approach you're taking, I think it's the best way to kind of get that message out there. But what exactly, of all the places you've been or everything you've seen, what have you found to be the most egregious, I guess?
Maybe the beach. I grew up on the Texas coast. It used to be a grueling walk through the scorching desert from the water to the dunes. It could easily be well over 100 yards, 150 yards. That was when I was growing up, and as recently as the late 90s, the beach was still huge. Since the turn of the century, the beach has really shrunk. And I've been looking at some of the tide data. It's at its maximum or minimum extents right about now. And the issue with that, like the issue with a lot of the things going on with this climate threshold crossing, is that we've just crossed over the normal limits of kind of like weather phenomena. And in the past, it was fairly easy to say, well, it's been this hot or this dry in the past. The tide has been this high in the past. But it's always gone down. The thing is, with the heat we've got on the planet now, with the accelerated melt in the Arctic and the Antarctic, this time it's not going to go down. Global warming, climate change is not going to stop. It's going to accelerate. That's one of the main characteristics of climate change, is that it feeds upon itself. The warmer it gets, the more carbon dioxide that the planet produces or is retained, because the less carbon dioxide is able to be absorbed by the oceans. The warmer it gets, the less productive the forests are. Contrary, there's a point, and we've probably already reached that point, the carbon dioxide fertilization point, where the forests start being sick, having infestations and diseases more often, so they're actually growing less. And there's just a recent paper out very recently that says we've probably passed this point. So the climate continues to get warmer. It's not going to slow down. It's going to last for quite some time.
You're listening to In the Know on 91.7 KVRX Austin. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Listening to In the Know 91.7 KVRX Austin. We're talking about climate change. We're talking about the environment and how exactly it's going to affect us in the near future. We have Bruce Melton with us here in the studio. Hey. Welcome again, Bruce. If you'd like to ask Bruce a question or if you yourself would like to throw in something about this topic, give us a call at 512-495-KVRX, which is 5879, or you can blog with us or you can even Facebook us. I mean, I'm logged on just in case some of you would like to chat there. But we're going to throw back into it, and I'm going to go to Katie for a question.
Yes. Okay. Well, I was telling Bruce during the break that I really like how all of his information is scientific, because I have not been to the Antarctic and I have not seen any of this firsthand. And I feel like personally, so much of the information about global warming that we hear is so politically charged. I mean, Al Gore was not a scientist and here he is winning the Nobel Peace Prize. And that kind of just hits a nerve with me. But then now that I'm hearing you and all the evidence that you have, I'm starting to become more of a believer. So my question for you right now is, in the 1970s, of course, the big scare was global cooling. And how does that compare to global warming now? And what are your thoughts on that?
That's a good one. Global cooling, if you guys weren't there.
That is true.
I was there. California, they'd have these smog days in California that were just unbelievable. And that's when California became so much of an environmental regulatory haven. That's where California got all that from. And so what happened was the smog from our automobiles, mostly from America, a bit from the rest of the West, but mostly from America, and our industry, because we had very few environmental controls after World War II and up until the early 70s. You know, this is the time when the Cuyahoga River, Baltimore, somewhere up in the Northeast, this river caught on fire. Water pollution was so bad. Industry was dumping so many volatile, flammable things into the rivers. And this river did this repeatedly. And it's basically the reason for the dawn of the environmental movement. At this time, air pollution was so bad, it affected the entire Earth as a sign of, you know, people say man is too small to affect the planet. We've done it already very markedly. Ozone is another instance where we've affected the planet. We're lucky to be here. We're still having trouble with ozone. But up through the 60s, the 50s and the 60s, we so much polluted this planet that the particulate pollution, you hear a lot about particulate pollution coming from diesel trucks. It's dust. It's unburnt hydrocarbons. It's soot. Comes from factories and cars. There's so much of it in the atmosphere. This is a type of pollution that reflects heat back into space. There was so much of it in the atmosphere. It reflected enough heat into space to cause not so much a global cooling, but it was a halt to the rapid warming that was happening. And temperatures leveled out. They may have started to fall just a tad, but they leveled out for not quite a decade. The pollution got so bad, temperature has nothing to do with this. It was very, very little known global temperature issues back then. It was pollution that was the big deal. That was when the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the Pesticide Reform Act were all put into law or made much stronger than they had previously been. And the thing with particulate pollution, it's heavy. It's soot. It falls out of the atmosphere naturally. It gets washed out of the atmosphere. It's what you get out of a volcano, or a lot of what you get out of a volcano. And even volcanoes, their cooling effect only lasts for a couple of years. It's just not a very long-lived thing because the physical properties of the soot make it such that it gets washed out or falls out of the atmosphere. Within just a couple of years of the passage of the Clean Air Act, our temperature started to rise on the very same curve that it was rising on before about the early 60s, sometimes when it got so bad that it actually started affecting the temperature. Before that time, it wasn't so bad. We had not crossed this threshold. Things were changing normally according to these forcings, how we were polluting the planet. And so once we cross that threshold, things quit happening. It quit warming, started cooling. Then we enacted the regulations. Within a couple of years, the atmosphere got clean enough, and it started warming again.
For those of you just joining us, you are listening to In the Know on 91.7 FM, KVRX Austin. We are here in studio with Bruce Melton of Melton Engineering here in Austin. Bruce, now, you and I exchanged some emails in the past week in preparation for this show, and one thing that just really alarms me that you wrote is this big scientist, James Hansen, makes a statement here that says, we have 4 years to fix the climate, or we totally lose it. That I looked at that, and I just, man,
not
we're screwed. You know what?
That's what it sounds like.
Can you elaborate on the study that he did that found this out? And I mean, do you see any light at the end of the tunnel for this?
Let me answer the scariest question first. Yes, I do see light at the end of the tunnel, and it comes with a big capital O and with a president in front of it. We can do something. There is enough money on this planet. There is enough time. The question is there enough heart? And we found a lot of heart, and we're going to be doing something very rapidly. And hopefully it will be enough, and hopefully we'll learn enough. We're learning so rapidly about climate science. This James Hansen guy, he is the director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. And what that is basically the U.S. government's climate modeling agency. He's the chief climate modeler for the U.S. government. He's likely the most important climate modeler in the world. This guy is making these scary statements. He made another one in December at the American Geophysical Union meeting, the annual meeting. The American Geophysical Union, I believe it's the biggest organization of scientists, of earth scientists, and it's of earth scientists. 16,000 earth scientists attended this meeting in San Francisco. That's not the membership of this organization. That's how many scientists attended this meeting. 16,000. James Hansen, his presentation, one of the most important presentations, was about the Venus syndrome. And the Venus syndrome, I'm sure a lot of you know, Venus doesn't have an atmosphere. It has runaway global warming. Well, it does have an atmosphere. It's mostly carbon dioxide. It doesn't have any water. It doesn't have any oceans. They all evaporated a long time ago. Its atmosphere is mostly carbon dioxide. It's got runaway global warming. The average temperature there is 450 degrees or something like that. Hansen told this most prestigious group, this most prestigious climate modeler in the world, told this huge group of scientists, earth scientists, if we burn all the coal on the planet, I'm sorry, all the oil on the planet, it's likely that our planet will encounter the Venus syndrome. If we burn all of the oil shale and the tar sands on the planet, it's inevitable. I mean, so it's just another one of those frightening things that really important scientists are saying. If we continue with business as usual, we really will destroy the planet. And, you know, I talked about publish or perish a little while ago. The same thing goes for these guys talking in public. They've got to be on their game or they lose credibility.
Something you said right now about the light at the end of the tunnel, and it's a big O, obviously a reference to President Obama. And I know Obama, he's trying to get this new stimulus package, about $819 billion. And he's saying that $77 billion of those dollars are going to go to trying to get the United States, you know, energy independent, trying to do some different things. And there's something that he wrote on the White House website that I'd like to read. And it says, quote, first, we have to take bold action to create a new American energy economy that creates millions of jobs for people. And he's also saying that we're trying to take a journey toward energy independence as we develop new energy, set new fuel efficiency standards, and address greenhouse gas emissions. Now, something that I found out a couple days ago is, you know, water vapor is a greenhouse gas.
Sure is. It's the most important greenhouse gas.
But how does that affect us in terms of what's going to happen to the environment in the near future?
Well, water vapor is a feedback. The warmer it gets, the more water evaporates. The more water vapor the atmosphere will hold. Water has the highest greenhouse potential, water vapor. It doesn't stay in the atmosphere as long, or its life is different, and the average humidity has a lot to do with the water vapor feedback. But the warmer it is, the more water vapor there is, so the warmer it gets. Back to this feedback thing. It's like a population explosion. There's a lot more, many more greenhouse gases other than water that are important too. Methane is natural gas. There's enough frozen methane on the floor of the ocean. It's like three times more frozen methane on the floor of the ocean. And frozen methane is 70 or 80 something degrees below zero. It's 140 degrees below zero. But at great pressures, at greater than 2,000 feet beneath the ocean, it can stay in a solid form as ice. It's called methane clathrates. There's enough natural gas on the ocean floor to equal three or four times all of the coal, oil, natural gas that has ever been burned on the planet and is still in the ground. And it's starting to melt, and it's possibly to blame for these recent increase in atmospheric methane levels. When methane levels over the last 10 years have stabilized because our society has learned how to basically do agriculture in more efficient ways so that we don't release so much methane.
But how plausible do you think it is that $77 billion is going to be, let's say, a jump start to going in that direction, that we're going to try and turn this country around in terms of their energy dependence? Do you think, I know one of the things that he was saying is looking forward to more wind power or solar power. How plausible is that to rely on to sustain this nation?
It's a great start. It's so much more than we have been doing. He's going to play a large part in the precursor agreement to Kyoto that is getting close to happening. I mean, they've been working on it for 2 years. In December of next year, they're going to finalize it in Copenhagen. We've got to start somewhere. $77 billion is certainly a great start. And I'm looking forward to a lot more than that being spent on it. It's a great place to put stimulus money for new infrastructure, for example. Instead of building more lanes of highway, let's build some clean energy production.
All right. Real quick announcement to make to all of our listeners there. It's time for another KVRX giveaway brought to you by your friends here at In the Know. It's for Thursday. That's tomorrow, January 29th at Emo's. Pickle Punk, Summer of Blood, Branch Davidian, Exile, and Combat Shock. That's outside. Golden Boys, Blood Royale, You People, Me Versus Everybody, and Black Tornadoes. That's inside. A lot of bands, and we'll give you a plus one. That means two guest list passes. If you call in right now, 512-495-KVRX for the show tomorrow night at Emo's. Now, Bruce, one of the films on your website is called What Have We Done? And this is interesting to me because it hits kind of close to home because I have family in Colorado near the Rockies. I've been there several times. What is going on there? It's like a mass deforestation that is depicted in this film. What exactly is that?
It's another one of these astonishing things. Everybody and their brother, except for the U.S. Forest Service, says that this never-before-seen, unprecedented bark beetle pandemic, basically, is what it is. It's the same old mountain pine beetle that has killed countless millions of acres of trees in the Rockies over the millennia. Only now we're seeing an order of magnitude 10 times more trees than the greatest tree kill ever encountered in recorded history. And it's the Colorado State Forest Service, the Canadian National Forest Service, and an outfit called the Rocky Mountain Climate Organization, which is 17 government agencies, 17 private organizations, and 11 nonprofits. All these people say that climate change is the primary cause of this massive beetle outbreak. The temperatures in the Rockies are increasing at twice the rate of the global average temperature, which is a kind of polar effect. A lot of people have heard that the poles, the Arctic regions, climate change is amplified in Arctic regions. It's because of the sensitivity of those environments. In the high altitude mountains, you get the same kind of effect. The more sensitive the environment, the more easy it is for that environment to cross a threshold and become less than optimal. And when you have that happen in an environment, you get the opportunity for something dramatic to happen. And we're having these beetle outbreaks. In Colorado, we've got 2 million acres have been killed in the last decade. In the rest of the West, we've got 4 to 5 million acres. In Canada is where you really get into the dense forests that are affected by this mountain pine beetle. And the forests are the lodgepole pine forest, and they make up about 11% of the forest in the Rockies, in the North American Rockies. The Rocky Mountain Climate Organization, Canadian Forest Service, Colorado State Forest Service, all these people are in agreement. In the next 3 to 5 years, before I tell you this, in Canada, 33 million acres. Canada is really where the big pandemic is. So the astounding news, all these three big agencies are saying the next 3 to 5 years that all of our mature lodgepole pine forest, which about 11% of the trees in the Rockies, are going to be dead in 3 to 5 years. Now, what's going to happen after that is there are other forests that are in line, so to speak, in the climate change pecking order. As the warmth spreads further north, there's is what's called the boreal forest, which is the great northern forest of the world. They make up 15% of the Earth's landmass. Those forests are sickening. They're beginning to show outbreaks of beetle, of different kinds of disease. They're next. It's not going to take a whole lot of warming until we start losing the largest forest in the world, which are these boreal forests.
Let's go ahead and play a little bit of that song, What Have We Done, by Mr. Melton's band, Climate Change. Bruce's song entitled What Have We Done? And I know, Aaron, you're gonna go ahead and try and end this with one last question.
Absolutely. Well, if you go to Bruce's website at meltonengineering.com, it does present a lot of films, a lot of literature on this this real climate change emergency, and I think it's fair to call it an emergency.
Yes, it really
absolutely
is.
But as a student, I have limited funds to contribute to, you know, really putting money forth to change this. But there are some things that anyone, you and I, anyone listening, can do. It says here, tell your friends about abrupt climate change. Vote for the strongest environmentally candidate available. Nothing else matters. Do what we already know to be green. And when someone or something is being wasteful, no matter how small or how large, speak up, be nice, and then if you can, try to think of a new solution that is better than the old solution. Bruce, do you have any closing words to give us hope for turning this thing around?
Yes, we can. We can do it. Concentrate on the positive and try not to listen to negativity too much. I did a show on your sister station called Good News last year. And it was the scary Halloween edition of Good News. And all of these things that I have been telling y'all tonight, it's all good news. Now we know how large of a battle we have. Now we know that we're going to have to be much more aggressive than we thought, even under Kyoto. So tell your friends, try and educate yourself as much as possible. It's all about knowledge and spreading the knowledge. And once we get the knowledge spread, we'll get the votes and we'll get the large programs implemented that can have a significant effect.
You've been listening to In the Know on 91.7 KVRX Austin. Right now, I'd just like to take the opportunity to thank Mr. Mellon for coming on to our show, blessing
guys.
Us with your knowledge. I know that's one of the, like we had mentioned earlier, it's one of those topics that a lot of people don't know about because of its complexity, but you're able to give it that little simplistic turn that a lot of us need in order to understand exactly.
People think, oh, science, you know. But, one thing, I'm going to plug that website because that helped me a lot to understand. MeltonEngineering.com was good, and the films were very informative to me, I thought. And
once again, we'd like to thank Mr. Mellon as well as Perla Sarabia Johnson. She will be at her book signing at the Barnes & Noble's at the Arboretum from 2 to 4 this Saturday. Once again, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on In the Know. I'm Jorge Olivares.
I'm Aaron Aiken.
And I'm Katie Dempsey.
And now, you're In the Know.